Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're on the road and in our mobile studio once again, so things look a little different, and I hope you bear with us. The important thing is the quality of the content, and we will surprise you, I think, with this unsurpassed content of Dr. David Wormser, a friend and colleague of mine at the Center for Security Policy. He's our duty expert on the Middle East. There's a lot going on there at the moment, and he's giving us a full hour of his time to explore it all, and I think you will find it fascinating. David brings a wealth of extraordinarily important experience to the subjects. He's been a naval intelligence officer, rising to the ranks of lieutenant commander. He has been, among other things, an aide to the Vice President of the United States, specializing in these subjects. Also, the National Security Advisor, also an Undersecretary of State. He's a man, in short, who knows his way around Washington, officialdom, and the world. And we're always delighted to catch up with him. David, again, thank you for taking this much time to read us in on what has been happening. You've just returned, as it happens, from the Middle East. In particular, in Israel, you were speaking about 30 years after the so-called Oslo peace process was initiated, doing stock-taking and, well, a critical analysis of, I think, everything that flowed from it. Give us a flavor of what you were telling your Israeli audience and what ours should know as well.
Well, sure. Thank you. And it's always an honor to be on with you, Frank, and a pleasure. So, it is almost exactly 30 years. I believe September 12th was the exact 30-year anniversary of the signing of the Oslo Agreement, where Israel essentially recognized the PLO, signed an agreement with the Palestinian Liberation Organization to re-enter the PLO into the West Bank, Gaza, Judea, Samaria, Gaza, and essentially established the beginnings of a Palestinian state. And the consequences of that, we know, were awful very quickly by 2000, but by 1995, literally a year and a half after the signing, and within months of the re-entry of the PLO, you had the first wave of explosion of terrorism that eventually culminated in 2002-2003 in a vast explosion of terrorism that claimed thousands of Israeli lives in the end, even more Palestinian lives. So this peace agreement led to war, led to very bloody war, and Israel is still dealing with wave after wave of terrorism, not quite as bad as that, but wave after wave of terrorism. That it cannot.
I think it's fair to say, David, if it's not as bad as that, it's not for want of trying. Jihadis are at it again, doing what jihadis do. So this might sound incredible to people who thought that the PLO, they were told certainly by, well, not just Bill Clinton, of course, who helped with this. I guess actually it was Jimmy Carter initially, wasn't it? But whoever the president was at the time, the party line, and that of the Nobel Peace Committee, by the way, was that the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, under Yasser Arafat, was a partner for peace for Israel. And Israel was making all kinds of territorial and other concessions to it on that premise, was it not?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is this says a lot about the PLO and about ourselves. The PLO never changed. The PLO remained a terrorist organization created by the KGB with the intent purpose of hooking on to the larger world of liberation movements that were part of the Soviet strategy to destroy the West, Israel being a very focal point of it. Remember, in 1967, 1968, the United States was in retreat to some extent in the Cold War. We were in terrible trouble in Vietnam. The Soviets were seeking parity in nuclear weapons. The French had been kicked out of Algeria. So there was overall, and in Europe, we were beginning to face public unrest and so forth. So overall, there was a sense that we were in retreat. But then the Israelis in 1967 delivered a huge victory against Soviet weaponry and Soviet allies. So three of the four measures we were doing badly, but Israel was a bright spot. So the Soviets focused on Israel, and both conventionally as well as intellectually and geostrategically, and the PLO was the front of that. By bringing the PLO back into the tent, what happened then after that was the 73 war, and the Israelis they won, but it was such a bloody victory that the Soviets seemed to even tarnish the Western military capability through that war. So you entered the 80s with this feeling that on every front, the United States was retreating. The PLO was rising. Our conventional forces couldn't stand up to Soviet conventional forces. We had withdrawn from Vietnam, et cetera. And there was great concern in the West about itself, namely, there was in our universities and so forth. So the 80s came.
Malaise, I think, was Jimmy Carter's term for it, was it not?
Perfect. Malaise is exactly what it was. And then you had, of course, Iran Revolution, the American hostage crisis. And then came the Reagan era, and a number of things happened. The United States didn't accept Soviet parity anymore in nuclear weapons and tried to restore American predominance. Vietnam was a thing of history, and we were beginning to reassert ourselves across the world. And then in 1982, the Israelis did two things. One is they destroyed conventionally the core of the Soviet claim to military supremacy in Europe. They did it in Lebanon in the 1982 war, but by destroying the air defense system that the Soviets had set up there, the most advanced air defense system, they in essence showed that the military balance in Europe was still in America's favor. The
Very
second thing the Israelis did is they obliterated the PLO. Yeah. And the PLO was the cause célèbre. It was the vehicle through which there was a radical third world progressive assault on the West. They were the clearinghouse of international terrorism and international progressivism. So we ended the 80s with the Soviet Union collapsing and the progressive world in crisis.
Yeah, David, let me just add one other piece of this, and it's a bit more checkered than the trajectory you've just described, of course. The inauguration of Ronald Reagan brought with it the release preemptively of the hostages by the Iranian regime that had seized them 444 days before. A very significant testimony to the idea of Reagan as a proponent of peace through strength, being somebody that, those exemplars of, terrorism, yes, but I would argue evil in the world, didn't want to mess with. So they essentially gave him this concession as he was being sworn in. But then there were some continuing problems in Lebanon, of course, and you might talk just a little bit about them, backed by the Iranians, that was murderous towards American troops there. No.
Well, one of the ways that the Soviets and the KGB, as well as through the PLO, operated was that they essentially imported the destroyed terror infrastructure that Israel had destroyed in 1982. They essentially transplanted it into Iran and used it as a foundation. But it didn't, because it was anchored to the Islamic Republic, it had a bit less currency in the universities in the West and so forth than the PLO. But this is the structure that led to Hezbollah and eventually to all the forms of Islamist terror that we have today. And it did, of course, also help secular terrorism survive.
We have to take a short break on that point. Sure. We're going to talk about how these threats further evolved in the period after Ronald Reagan came to office, and how they are continuing to plague Israel as well as us to this day. David Wormser is in the house. Stay tuned for more right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Air Force Chief of Staff General C.Q. Brown warned his subordinates in writing last week about Chinese communist attempts to recruit serving personnel and veterans. The reason given is the interest the People's Liberation Army has in honing its understanding of U.S. military capabilities and practices as part of what the Services Secretary Frank Kendall says are PLA preparations for war with us. Unfortunately, General Brown himself may be encouraging U.S. airmen and women to be receptive to the Chinese Communist Party's temptations. After all, he has aggressively promoted Maoist cultural Marxist notions, including, for example, that America is a systemically and irremediably racist nation. The next Joint Chiefs Chairman must not divide, demoralize, and brainwash our troops with enemy propaganda, thereby encouraging them to betray a country unworthy of their service and sacrifice. Tell your senators, rejectgeneralbrown.org. This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back. Chuck DeVore is in the house, I'm very pleased to say, and he is reading us in a manner of speaking, to a terrific novel that he has written entitled The Crisis of a House Never United. And it's a tale that's rooted in the actual history of the country and what might have been had it not fortuitously come together as it did around the Constitution of 1789. Give us kind of where it goes off the tracks and what end, Chuck.
So what ends up happening is you have the Articles of Confederation in operation. Things they muddle through, but they have no standing army to speak of, and as a result, the Northwest territories are never claimed from the Native American tribes, who are being, of course, backed by the British. Eventually, though, Aaron Burr sees that this cannot continue, and he makes his move when George Washington, the last glue kind of barely holding together the colonies, or now the states under the Articles of Confederation, when he passes away in 1799. So he makes his move, and what he does, looking at Napoleon and how Napoleon came to power in the chaos of the French Revolution, yes, and he proposes to the Central Atlantic states of New York and New Jersey and Delaware and Pennsylvania, that they need to come together for their own protection and create a republic. And so he offers to run as president, and he's elected through a national popular vote. And of course, he optimizes the votes out of New York, because of course, all the states back then had property thresholds that you needed to meet,
yes,
to vote. And so what's interesting, of course, is, again, taken from real life, Aaron Burr was responsible for essentially the weaponization of what heretofore had been a social club called Tammany Hall in New York City. Mm. And in real life, he weaponized Tammany Hall to help Thomas Jefferson win New York in the 1800 election that, of course, he, because of the way the Electoral College worked back then, ended up in a tie with Thomas Jefferson, and it was a very nearly run thing. But in my book, what ends up happening is they take the money, just like happened in real life, and they loan the money from Tammany Hall to increase the votes. So using a national popular vote scheme, he was able to dominate and win that election with those four states. Very quickly then, he develops an alliance with Napoleon's France, helps Napoleon decide not to invade Haiti, which was a costly miscalculation on Napoleon's part, as well as the English before him. Together, both empires probably lost close to 100,000 troops trying to take Haiti. And instead says, hey, Napoleon, how'd you like to get Canada back and use New York as a platform to invade and retake Montreal and Quebec? And so that's where things begin to shift. And of course, Burr very quickly sees the utility in trying to take New England, where you had John Adams by that time kind of trying to hold things together. And in the meantime, the South is looking at this horrifically, saying, oh my goodness, what's going on here? This is not working out to our advantage. And so what ends up happening is eventually you see ratification of the Constitution happen, but only in the South, along with the exiles out of Massachusetts. And so you have these two forms of government essentially in opposition. You have a republic kind of ordered along the French lines with Aaron Burr as its chief. And eventually, and late, kind of late to the party, you have the Southern states organizing under Thomas Jefferson under the Constitution with a group of exiles from New England also kind of helping out. And so that's where things end up in the book. And Frank, the whole purpose of it was to acquaint a whole new generation of reader who may not be inclined to pick up a thick, heavy, serious tome about the Constitution or about our Revolutionary War history, but might instead be interested in a novel. And in the end of the book, I've got notes, all the historical notes that show the reader the deviation from actual history to the way it was in the book, so that if someone's interested, they could go back and learn more about what actually happened in that period.
Well, I think it's a real public service, Chuck, and thank you for taking the time to walk us through it, because I think these alternative histories do, in fact, stimulate some fresh thinking about what has actually happened and what it led to. And I guess I just would ask, if we had not come together as a nation around this Constitution, and that made possible the westward expansion, and that made possible ultimately the industrialization in the North, and you know, the Civil War that followed, and then coming together after that and becoming a world power, what do you think the world would have looked like without a strong America, at least as we saw it emerge in that period?
Right. So in the Federalist Papers, you see this concern that commercial republics are natural rivals of each other. And given the history of North America and Europe, that what would quickly happen is you'd have these different configurations of states seeking succor from the British and from the French and from the Spanish. And that you would essentially have a continuation of European wars on the North American continent. I have no reason to doubt that the founders were correct in that fear. And so what I would imagine is the key would be, what would be the development of the British Empire? Would the British Empire have been a sufficient stand-in for a strong America? Or would a divided North America have also crippled England? And if so, for example, might Napoleon have been successful in his effort to unify continental Europe under his rule? And so I think that in all probability, the likelihood of tyranny, of a dark lack of freedom throughout the world, likely would have been the case had this nation failed to launch on its successful project.
Fascinating. And also perhaps a prognosis for where we wind up in the event the United States comes undone in our own time. You know, there's talk about the great separation between blue states and red states. There's even talk of civil war as a result of perhaps, you know, the provocations, it seems to me, of the Biden team ultimately generating sufficient opposition that it goes very, very badly. I think there's no doubt that the world would be a darker and more dangerous place without the United States, don't you?
Well, I do indeed. And of course, the key is that I think there are two things, right? You have the founding premise of the country that's largely drawn from John Locke, and of course captured in the preamble of the Declaration. But to give that form and to really make it operate, you needed the structure of subsequent philosophers like Montesquieu, and how that then was kind of built into the framework, into the skeleton of the Constitution, which presumes that, of course, men lust after power, and that you have to set ambition against ambition, and you have to have these three co-equal branches of government that each zealously guard their own prerogatives. And unfortunately, yes, in recent times, we become unbalanced. The Congress has ceded far too much of its authority to an unelected permanent bureaucracy.
Right.
I think that is at the root of many of our problems.
I couldn't agree more, Chuck. And I, again, having experience in a legislative assembly out in California, you have a sense of what happens when these things do get unbalanced, whether it's at the state level or at the federal level. And the world is a darker place, in part, I think, because we are not the nation that we have been, and perhaps will become even less so if we wind up, for example, ceding more ground to the Chinese Communist Party. We're going to take a very short break. When we come back, I want to drill down with you, Chuck, a little bit on one of your other important works of literature, namely China Attacks, insights from it for our present time and future, right after this.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back to our conversation, which continues with Chuck DeVore, a former very successful state assemblyman in California, who early on saw the need to relocate to Texas, as an awful lot of other Californians have done in recent years. Chuck, we've had an opportunity to talk with you a bit about one of your books. I wanted to turn to another one, even earlier, I think, in your career. Informed, obviously, by your experience as an intelligence officer in the United States Army National Guard. It's entitled China Attacks, and it looked at what might eventuate if somebody, like Xi Jinping, were to decide to act on the historic ambitions of the Chinese Communist Party to force Taiwan to submit to the CCP's rule. Give us a flavor of both, you know, that particular work, but also where you think we are in that regard in the moment.
Right. So I researched the need for this book clear back in 1998. I looked at the literature and saw that you had a few cloak and dagger books about China, but there was no book at the time about a serious conventional assault by China on Taiwan. And of course, all the experts scoffed at such a thing. Oh, it'd be a million man swim and it'd be impossible, et cetera. And what I wanted to do was explore the ideological reasons, the strategic reasons why China would do this, especially at a time when, as you may recall, we were dealing with things like permanent most favored nation trading status and allowing China to join the trade organization, right? Mm-hmm. The WTO. And so I thought that those were big mistakes. And lastly, again, for the rationale of the book, that China, with a population about five times that of the United States, you know, a little over 20 years ago, I couldn't imagine that as they began to adopt the state-directed capitalism, really more of a fascist type of a model, that it wouldn't at least be as efficient as the Soviet Union's economy, which was much more centrally controlled. And during the height of the Cold War, the old Soviet Union, with about 10% more of our population than we had, had about 50% of our GDP. And so I figured China, with five times the people, even if they were at the same level of efficiency relative to us as the old USSR, that would be an economy at least double the size of the American economy. So I thought it was not prudent on our part to just presume that trade with America would somehow liberalize the Chinese Communist Party. I mean, remember, I wrote this, I started to research it about 9 years after Tiananmen Square, and I certainly didn't think the leopard was about to change its spots.
Right.
So I was able to attract onto the team of writing a co-author. And of course, you all know him pretty well. It's Stephen Mosier, someone who's an expert sinologist. He's fluent in Mandarin and Cantonese. He's been there a number of times, has researched there. And so what I had Steve do is I had him write the sections of the book that take place in China. I dealt with the military aspects of it. I war gamed everything out. I built an order of battle for both sides and war gamed it out. And we got the book out there, and I'll be darned if it didn't get huge favorable coverage in the Financial Times of London on page 3 on the top of the fold, 7 of the 8 columns across.
Wow.
And from there, I ended up picking up a publisher from Taiwan who asked for the English language rights in Asia, which we granted. And then a few weeks after that, after presumably he read the book, we ended up getting an offer to have the book translated into a traditional character Chinese for sale in Hong Kong and in Taiwan, but of course banned in mainland China. That would never happen. I ended up going back to Taiwan, where I addressed about 250 people in an auditorium next to their national legislature. So this was an audience of lawmakers and staff and some military personnel. There were two lawmakers with me and the deputy of their war college. And in the middle of our presentation, the official spokesman for the pro-Beijing, you know, Unify Without Any Preconditions Party, shows up to denounce me and the book and the panel. So I got the official kind of stilted running dog capitalist imperialist type denunciation from the mouthpiece of Beijing, which was quite the treatment. You know, I felt very honored by that. So yeah.
You'd obviously gotten under their skin.
Right, exactly.
In Beijing, not just in Taiwan.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the book, I was on their nightly TV 3 nights in a row on all their major networks. I saw my book in the bookstores there. It did very well. And subsequently, I went back to Taiwan a few years later when I was a lawmaker and found out that my book made quite the impression with the Mainland Affairs Council, which is kind of like Taiwan's National Security Council, only focused exclusively on the problem with mainland China. So the book is basically a Tom Clancy techno thriller. It applies my understanding of how the military art works. Certainly it's a bit dated now because it had technology and methods from 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But that said, the politics, right, the geostrategic aspect of the book remains sound. And that's why we wrote
and
the book.
The concern, if anything, is heightened at this point, it seems to me, and should be informed by what you've written, even though it was out of an earlier era. Do you think at the moment, knowing what you do, not only about what the Chinese preparations have been,
right,
now that the World Trade Organization and infusions of capital and technology from our country for decades has transformed the place into quite a powerful nation, that it would be a million-man swim if they undertook an attack? Chuck?
Yeah, so that's the huge question, right? I mean, you can look at numbers on a piece of paper, but it's also it's extremely hard to understand, as we see with Russia's hard time that they've had with their invasion of Ukraine, right? If all you did was look at numbers, you'd think, oh, Ukraine would quickly lose to the Russian Federation. And the reason why they haven't, of course, is that they enjoy a higher level of morale, they have a better NCO corps. They have, of course, now the support of the West with all of that entails as far as materiel and intelligence. But there's also intangibles like morale. And we don't really know, given that the last conventional conflict that China had was in 1979 with a Vietnam that was just flush with victory in the Vietnam War, had all kinds of U.S. equipment that it absorbed and incorporated within to its military. And, you know, China goes in to try to teach Vietnam a lesson for toppling their client state in Cambodia. And within a month, ends up losing about five times the number of people that America lost in 12 years of fighting in Vietnam. And so it wasn't a particularly good experience for them.
Yeah.
So it's hard to tell. I mean, obviously, if you read your Sun Tzu and if you look at CCP tactics, you know, they would prefer to take Taiwan without a shot. They would prefer to intimidate them into giving up their freedoms, into just looking at this as an inevitability, and that they're going to be abandoned by America and by Japan, and that they should just give up and avoid the bloodshed.
Right.
I don't think that's going to happen. You know, you, every year it seems like Taiwan is developing more and more of its own national identity, similar to what you saw in Ukraine after the breakup of the Soviet Union. Now, what the Taiwanese lacked, that the Ukrainians didn't, though, was a grim determination to defend that independence, as you see with Ukraine's ongoing fight. That is the big question with Taiwan is, will they look at this seriously enough to, for example, develop a real National Guard that would be locally based? Because right now, the Achilles heel, I think, for Taiwan is they have this massive reserve system on paper, but they only train most of the soldiers no more than 5 days every year. And most of that's a paperwork drill. You compare that to our Reserve and National Guard, which trains at a minimum 39 days a year. So you can't even compare the two.
Yeah. Chuck, there's so much to plumb there. And I guess I just one quick question before we have to take another break. I thought where you were going with that is that Taiwan has not only been developing their own sense of themselves as really a democratic people, quite separate from China, but also developing their own arsenal, because it has turned out to be very difficult to rely upon the provision of arms from the United States. The question that looms is, will they adopt the technology they clearly have to acquire nuclear capabilities as well, do you think?
Well, that's certainly an open question. And they did have a viable nuclear program that was eventually shut down. And I think the problem with that is—
At our insistence.
Right. I think the problem with that is that the current party in power, the Democratic Progressive Party, is also an environmental party. And by our standards, it'd be left of center and would be anti-nuclear. And so while that would make a lot of sense, I'm not quite sure that the Democratic Progressive Party is willing to go that far and arm themselves. Now, Japan is another matter. Of course, they have an enormous stockpile of plutonium that the French helped them reprocess.
So they have the option basically at any time. I suspect the South Koreans do as well, and there's actual talk with all of the threats coming out of North Korea that they may exercise that option, as you know. But Taiwan, I would think, has to be weighing that one pretty carefully as well, because at the end of the day, the evidence seems to be building that Xi Jinping has in mind going for it, and our purpose ought to be trying to make sure that we're deterring it, if at all possible, which is a topic to which I hope to return with you in a moment. Chuck DeVore, we're going to talk about the United States military, the state it is in at the moment, and what only seems to me to be efforts by Marxists, some in uniform, no less, to take it down. Hardly the formula for deterring the Chinese from attacking, well, Taiwan, for starters, but perhaps us as well. We'll talk more about that with Chuck DeVore right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Air Force Chief of Staff General C.Q. Brown warned his subordinates in writing last week about Chinese communist attempts to recruit serving personnel and veterans. The reason given is the interest the People's Liberation Army has in honing its understanding of U.S. military capabilities and practices as part of what the Services Secretary Frank Kendall says are PLA preparations for war with us. Unfortunately, General Brown himself may be encouraging U.S. airmen and women to be receptive to the Chinese Communist Party's temptations. After all, he has aggressively promoted Maoist cultural Marxist notions, including, for example, that America is a systemically and irremediably racist nation. The next Joint Chiefs Chairman must not divide, demoralize, and brainwash our troops with enemy propaganda, thereby encouraging them to betray a country unworthy of their service and sacrifice. Tell your senators, rejectgeneralbrown.org. This is Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are continuing this extraordinarily important conversation with Chuck DeVore, these days the chief for national priorities at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, but a man of great experience. And we've been talking about various aspects of his distinguished career that have informed his books of fiction and his analyses and his commentary, and you can find them often at foxnews.com, among other outlets, and I commend them to you. Chuck, I was asking you at the break about whither the United States military, and I mean that both in the sense of where they headed and are they withering under an assault that seems to be really a very deliberate takedown. I ascribe principally to the Biden administration, but to its predecessors. In fact, I think of this as the third Obama-Biden term, really. And certainly Obama-Biden 1.0 and 2.0 put the military on its present trajectory of, purging warriors, people like yourself, in favor of people who are going to go along with their ideological program. And we've got a bunch of them now in senior ranks, some of whom are being held up by the Senate, in the Senate by Senator Tuberville, in part now, I think, because of this so-called woke ideology. And I wonder what your thoughts are, sir, especially about whether this is what we need in the way of a military to deter this adversary in China.
Yeah, so this is not a new problem, right? The demands of command, especially in the field, are very different than the demands of maneuvering within the corridors of power in Washington, D.C. You certainly have seen that personally, as have I, when we had the opportunity to serve President Reagan in the Department of Defense together at the same
time. Back when men were men.
Yeah, hard to believe. And so you certainly saw this during the Clinton administration as well. In fact, my own promotion to major was delayed by a full year because a group of JAG officers in the Army were not promoted as they expected to be. And in fact, they made the claim, later borne out in their legal process, that there were women and minorities who were less qualified that were promoted ahead of them. And so they canceled the promotion for the entire year. What they ended up doing is just waiting another year and rolling in those individuals who had sued, who were ranked higher on the officer evaluation reports, as well as the individuals who were included in the first pass through, who missed or who made the promotion. And so they presumably had a slightly smaller class after 2 years. And that was for JAG officers, it was for intelligence officers, and it was for doctors.
But Chuck, the question at hand is, in this present environment, are we in fact so hollowing out the military, not just because of these promotions, but because of these policies, that an adversary like the Chinese, a pure competitor, as they say, in the military, is now emboldened to think that they can have their way with not just our friends, but us.
So my main goal in bringing up that older example is that this is not a new problem. This is something that we've seen. And part of the challenge is that I think that generally speaking, conservatives are often blind to what the other side is doing and how they view the military as an instrument of social change and as something that needs to be melded for something other than winning wars and defeating an enemy. Mm-hmm. And so you saw that at the advent of the Biden administration, where this scurrilous claim was made that veterans and active duty personnel and reservists were somehow overrepresented in the people arrested in the wake of the January 6th Capitol riot. Right. I looked at the numbers and determined that, in fact, that was not the case, that you had to adjust for age and for the amount of males who participated, et cetera. That finding has subsequently been confirmed by a number of other groups, not just someone who's right of center like me. But remember what happened immediately is you had Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin saying, oh, we have a problem with white supremacy in the ranks. He did a stand down service-wide to attack a problem that did not exist based on the false premise that came out of January 6th. And so that's the environment in which we're operating. And so unfortunately now, you're seeing the services, except for the very small Space Force, not making their recruiting goals. I know that last year, I think the Marine Corps did. Now, I think the last I saw, the Marine Corps is starting to have problems recruiting as well. As a result, we're dropping our standards. That has implications for follow-on insofar as problems with drug abuse or suicide or good order and discipline in the ranks. If you're beginning to accept people who, for example, have criminal records or lower scores, they're going to be more difficult to lead, and it's going to result in a force that's less capable, especially in this modern era with our highly complex weapon systems.
Right.
And so, and lastly, Frank, what happens is when you focus on anything other than warfighting, not only do you cause kind of this collective punishment attitude where everybody must be guilty of something as you're harangued about diversity and equity and inclusion.
White supremacism
all
and
right, all of this stuff. Any minute spent on this stuff is time spent away from war fighting and preparing for war and maintaining your equipment and training on your equipment. It's dangerous stuff, and we ought not to be engaged in it. If someone is a problem in a unit because they're a jerk and they're prejudicial, you discipline them. And if you still have a problem, you get rid of them. You kick them out. You don't have these struggle sessions led by people who are not war fighters. That is counterproductive.
Classic Marxism.
Military.
Exactly right. And I think that's what we're seeing, in fact. And to the extent we are, there's no question in my mind that we're weakening the force. And, I believe very strongly as a former staff member on the Senate Armed Services Committee that it has failed to do the kind of oversight and quality control that needs to be done here. And it's vital, it seems to me, that there be some kind of intervention by the Senate with a population in the military leadership at the moment that have drunk the Kool-Aid. You know, this is the kind of thing you do when people have drinking problems. Well, the ideological imbibing that's been taking place, I think, for now some time, and not just CQ Brown, by the way, and not just the designated new Chief of Naval Operations, Lisa Franchetti. It's I think rife throughout this group that's being promoted, and it needs to be addressed as such, because I think at the end of the day, it's an invitation to aggression by our enemies. Chuck, you have a new report out. We're going to talk about that next. We'll be right back with more right after this. Welcome back to this final installment of our very important conversation with a man I respect greatly, Chuck DeVore, Lieutenant Colonel, United States Army National Guard, retired, among many other things. And Chuck, one of the things that you're doing now at the Texas Public Policy Foundation is offering some very important insights into what we need to be doing to enhance the resiliency of our country with civil defense and the grid and the like. Tell us about your new report, how people can find it, and its most important insights.
Well, thank you, Frank. Yeah, the report just dropped on September 12th. It's called Texas Defense. I'm the author of the report. The report came out of this realization that we don't do in America, we really don't do civil defense anymore. And there's a few reasons for that, right? You ended up with, during the Cold War, a concerted effort by the left that basically had the attitude, what's the point, right? We're all going to die in a nuclear war anyway. And it's giving the children nightmares, et cetera. And you have people that mock, for example, the duck and cover drills. I even had, an intern here who later became a staffer that once, kind of made a joke of, about the duck and cover drills. And I said, well, they work. The reason why they were done is we studied how was it that people died during the bombing campaigns of World War II, not only the London Blitz, but of course, against the Axis powers. And later, of course, the two atomic bombs dropped over Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And one of the number one mechanisms of dying was you bled out because you were cut by flying glass.
Right.
And so when you think of, for example, a nuclear bomb going off, the blast and the thermal and the radiation is really confined to a relatively small surface area, whereas the destructive radius of the weapon is much, much larger because of the overpressure wave, where you basically have this wave of air going several hundred miles an hour that can shatter windows, ended up cutting people. So
civil defense is a piece of this. What are you recommending in that regard?
Well, so what I'm recommending is that it's very prudent for states, especially a large state like Texas, that's kind of a national leader, to assess the terrain and to look at areas that the federal government has abdicated and say, what prudent, cost-effective states might a state take to basically fill the gap and to begin a process of rebuilding civil defense in certain areas. And so I found three areas that would be very cost effective and very easy for the state of Texas to work on. Number one, we can do a far better job securing our grid. The large power transformers that we use to carry our high voltage electricity, about 70% of the electricity is moved in the country through these large power transformers. Most of those are imported, the plurality of which come from China. And there was some concern there at the end of the Trump administration that some of these pieces of equipment from China might contain Trojan horses that would allow a back door to damage or to turn off the transformer. And so we ought to have...
I believe there's actually evidence that that has happened, and it should be of great concern
right.
to us.
So we can store some of these on climate-controlled warehouses on National Guard properties around the state. These things are $2.5 to $4 million each. And because of property taxes, a utility, a generator isn't going to store them on site because they're going to end up paying property tax on it. But the state can do that and rotate them out when they're needed. A second thing is our medicine supply. There's been all kinds of arguments, mostly by the crowd that says, the China-US, alliance or chamber of commerce, I forget their exact trade name. But they assure us everything's fine. Only roughly 10% of our finished products, so far as medicines and drugs, come from China. Well, what they fail to admit to the public is that it looks like maybe 90 to 95% of the key starting ingredients,
so-called APIs,
that are used to build these drugs, come from China, and they're not exactly the most pure. They often are contaminated with cancer-causing agents, et cetera. And we just don't make these basic chemicals in the West anymore.
That's insane.
So if there's ever any sort of a conflict with China, we may find ourselves cut off from the ability, even things like antibiotics. So
right.
Why don't we store some antibiotics on site?
Good.
And then lastly, the Constitution allows states to have legal tender in gold and silver. Texas created its own bullion depository that was stood up in 2018. And that gives Texas the ability, through the modern advent of digital currency, to have a fractional digital currency in both gold and silver, and to have that as a backup medium of exchange should there be some sort of a concerted attack on our financial exchange system. It'd be very useful if Texas had the ability, for example, to pay vendors to begin to restore basic services, et cetera.
Yeah.
And I think it would make an attack a little less likely if our enemies knew that there was a viable backup system at the state level.
As you know, one of our colleagues, Kevin Freeman, has been very much engaged in championing just this approach.
And I quote him in the report.
Thank you. And not least because of concerns about what our own government may do.
Right.
Say nothing about our enemies, but you know, the central bank digital currency. These are such important initiatives, Chuck, and I really commend you for your leadership in identifying them as tractable problems that can be addressed. And I've long believed that because Texas has, as you know, its own grid, it is a perfect place to model these kinds of fixes, to make the grid more resilient, to stockpile supplies and develop microgrids. There's some very important work going on, as you know, in San Antonio to
try to in the report too.
Make it more resilient. So
your
leadership
is
really needed.
TexasPolicy.com is where you can find the report.
TexasPolicy.com, and the report is entitled
Texas Defense.
Texas Defense. Perfect. Chuck DeVore, we've covered a lot of ground, and there's a lot more to cover, and I look forward to further visits with you on all of this. But your insights, I think, particularly on, you know, the nature of this country, where we've come from, where we perhaps narrowly averted coming from, where we are at the moment, what bad actors like the Chinese Communist Party may have in mind for us if we don't deter them properly, and what we need to do to make ourselves a less inviting target, including through resiliency and medicines and grid and currency. And I think this is a really important contribution. Texas Defense sounds good to me. Godspeed and getting it out. We look forward to further talking with you about it in the near future. In the meantime, stay well. I hope the rest of you will join us again next time. And until then, you'll go forth and multiply.